Hello and welcome to the latest podcast. As usual, my name's James Skoltok. I'm the IMI's Motor Pro magazine editor. For this latest edition, we're sitting down with the IMI CEO, Steve Nash, to talk through some of the biggest topics facing the automotive sector at the moment, and some of the work the IMI is doing to support members. So, just to kick things off then, let's start with the MOT consultation, which, in a strange way, has brought the automotive sector to one, and everyone's got a unified voice, more or less. But what was the IMI stance to the MOT consultation, and what was the feedback you provided to them?
Well, I think you've made a very good point. Look, we always have had, as a sector, a unified view around the MOT. The thing is, of course, this comes around with monotonous regularity. I think the real driver for it on this, you know, on this occasion, actually on the last occasion, was because the government is definitely looking for something that they can say they've done to help people's cost of living that doesn't actually cost them any money, you know, that which is completely the wrong motivation for doing it. But the arguments against changing the frequency of the MOT are well documented. We've all submitted them before and they have succeeded on previous occasions, but we find ourselves back here again. So the IMI, from our perspective, we looked to find something different that we could add in. First of all, to understand the motivation for raising the question yet again and what evidence the government thought they might have that made the situation different now to the last time we all discussed it, which wasn't very long ago. And one of the clear motivators for them is the belief, and as it turns out, the mistaken belief, that as we move more towards plug-in vehicles, the relative mechanical simplicity of those vehicles compared to full internal combustion engine vehicles would mean that actually the reliability would be greater, the wear and tear factors would be less, and therefore, fundamentally, they wouldn't need MOTing as often. And we set about examining those premises and found them to be mistaken. Actually, certain wear and tear factors, most notably tyres, are higher with both full battery electric vehicles and plug-in hybrids because of the weight. Therefore, a vehicle that wasn't seen for an extended period of time, if it wasn't seen for 4 years, for example, tyres could be very well beyond their legal status by then. And of course, you know, it all comes down to safety, doesn't it? So it flew counter to the government's assumptions, which had never been examined by the government. They were just assumptions. And so I do believe that we've added something additional and useful to the debate.
It was IMI research, wasn't it, that showed that tyre wear is greater on plug-in hybrid and battery electric vehicles. But it seems strange, though, doesn't it, that the government doesn't or didn't think that could be a concern? Surely they have numerous advisors to them to say that actually X, Y, and Z occurs in vehicles that are not combustion engine vehicles.
Well, I'd love to say from my dealings with government that they listen to their advisors, but they don't always. I think they start from what it is they want to achieve. And like I said, I do believe the big motivator actually is to be able to say they've done something to save people cost, and therefore they're doing a little bit to help the general public on their cost of living. Albeit, again, a false premise, because safety checks missed 1 year, you know, which would cost a certain amount to put right, are likely to cost quite a lot more if they're not put right. You know, worn brake pads could become worn brake discs a year later, couldn't they? And the truth is, there is a lot of disconnect within government. You know, I mean, it's absolutely clear that the DVSA themselves, who are, you know, obviously sit behind the MOT test, have a very different view. Let's not forget, it's only just a handful of years ago the DVSA introduced the annual MOT tester qualification. And, you know, they're clearly looking to push the standard of the MOT up. I think the other thing is that is really, really key to this is that the government sort of understand half truths. So they look at other countries and they've quoted that, you know, France, for example, where the MOT is carried out on a different frequency. But one of the people that we work with on our research is himself a French national, and explained in detail what the French MOT looks like. And it's way more onerous than ours. It's way more complicated. It's way more onerous. If you fail, you have a very limited time in which to get the vehicle fixed, and then you have to have it retested again. And, you know, it's much more costly than ours. It's not like you're looking at an identical test that one person does every year and somebody else does every couple of years. Same in Germany. I know from my own background that the German TÜV test is quite a lot more involved than our MOT test. So, you know, they're dealing in half-truths, really.
Yeah. I might be cheeky and put you on the spot then, considering what you've said about what the government do and do not listen to. Given that the automotive sector has been unified, do you think they'll take that on board and listen to it and not make such big changes to the MOT as they're suggesting?
I sincerely hope so. I am worried that we did all of this not very long ago and we're back here again. So, I do think that certain we know from experience on a number of levels that the loudest voices in government tend to be in the Treasury. So it sort of depends who is pushing it. But they have had overwhelming evidence to show that there's little or no real world benefit, and that there are some very real safety risks. And, you know, even the cost of living thing is erroneous because, as we've said, you know, if you miss a certain level of necessary maintenance, it just becomes more expensive a year later. And of course, you know, we know from endless research that we've done and other automotive organisations have done a lot, particularly at times of when people are a bit hard pressed on costs. Many people, the only thing they actually do annually on their car is put it through the MOT because they have to. And they believe that if a car gets a clean MOT, then the car's okay. And they'll do what they have to do and only what they have to do. Well, if you take that away, they're not even going to be doing that, are they? You know, so, you know, bottom line is we'll end up with a lot more unsafe cars on the road. All of that information has been played to them. Some of it, you know, multiple times, but I do believe the case that's been put by the industry collectively, with the addition of that new information that we've been able to bring to the table, makes a powerful enough argument for them to realise the error of their ways if they were to consider changing. But you never know with government, do you? You know.
From what you've said, it kind of leads me on nicely to another topic. As you said, the IMI response to the MOT consultation was talking about, you know, wear and tear on new technology cars, battery electric, for example, plug-in vehicles, and TechSafe kind of encompasses that. That's the under the IMI umbrella. So would you mind talking us a little bit through TechSafe and why it's important to the automotive sector?
I would be delighted to do that, because I think it's always useful to kind of go back to first principles and restate why you went down a particular route. And I've got to say that, you know, what is now known as IMI TechSafe was sort of a bit of a personal hobby horse of mine. So it was sort of, I feel quite a lot of ownership of it. And we all know that, I say we all know, let me make the statement clearly that historically, for the 100 and odd years that the industry has existed as we know it, there has been no real regulation around who works on vehicles, who services and repairs cars. So the majority of the members of the public, you know, the motoring public, actually shop on price and convenience. They never ask whether the person working on their car is qualified. And interestingly enough, in discussions with government at the start of the process around this, it was pretty clear that most MPs didn't realise either. They kind of thought that there must be some, you know, they obviously would have known they were never involved in any discussions on it, but kind of thought that some of their predecessors must have been. So it came as a shock. And when you started to explain to them that we're we're shifting, you know, paradigms here. We're moving away from familiar technology we've worked with for 100-odd years to new technology, which has different levels of inherent risk. So working with high voltages, it very clearly has inherent risks for somebody who doesn't know what they're doing. And the skills that you have around working on internal combustion engine vehicles are not directly transferable to a fully electric vehicle or even a plug-in hybrid necessarily. So that was the sort of first point, was to say we actually need some regulation around this. You can't just have anybody who fancies having a go getting their hands under the bonnet of a car that's operating on anything up to sort of 700-800 volts of direct current that you know could be fatal. It wasn't an easy conversation with government because they declare themselves to be anti-regulation, and you know, basic principle that if you want a new regulation, you've got to point to at least two or three existing regulations we can take away. Not an easy job, you know. What we actually did realise, it was a little bit of a brainwave that myself and our good friend Tom Denton had coming back from a disappointing meeting with a minister, that actually there must be existing regulation, and it turned out there was. So to cut a very long story short, we took all of the right legal consultations and advice. We worked with the Health and Safety Executive, and ultimately we got government endorsement around a scheme that would qualify people in compliance with the Electricity at Work Act, very similar to the way that domestic and commercial electricians have to be qualified to do work at your house or your office or whatever. So, and as I say, the key thing was getting through what is now called OZEV, the Office for Zero Emission Vehicles, on behalf of the Department of Transport. We got that endorsement, and we also got the backing of the Health and Safety Executive. So very important, because actually the big risk there, apart from the existential risk to the person who may not know what they're doing under the bonnet of the car, the big risk there is to employers, because of course we were told by the Association of British Insurers that they were happy to see IMI TechSafe around electric vehicles, because actually if someone were to get injured in the workplace, they wanted to be able to see that the employer had properly trained and equipped that person. And if they couldn't see that, they wouldn't be looking to pay out on the liability insurance. And of course, on top of that, the Health and Safety Executive would be looking to lobby fines as well. So big risk to the employer. And so TechSafe not only makes sure that the person, the operative is appropriately skilled and can demonstrate, you know, actually has a proper a certified skill that they can put forward to customers, but the employer is protected from those risks, you know, those very real risks of being fined by the HSE and not getting an insurance payout to cover their liabilities. So very, very important. But IMI TechSafe is not just about EV. It's about the new technologies, the ACEs, as we call it, or particularly the ACE, the autonomous, connected and electric. Autonomous is slightly different because there is a bill going through Parliament very slowly, but that will be the basis for regulation around autonomous vehicles. And our job, our ongoing job, is to make sure that that includes appropriate regulation around people who work on those vehicles. Doesn't matter what level of autonomy we're talking about. Everything from sort of ADAS, really, you know, automated driver assistance systems, up to level 3 or anything that occurs beyond that. So whenever the car is driving itself, basically, you need to know it's going to do what it's expected to do. And you can't have somebody working on that who isn't properly qualified or skilled. And they need to be able to evidence that. There is a Law Society opinion, which is always important because it does guide regulation, that said that if a vehicle, an autonomous vehicle, anything, as I say, from sort of level 3 upwards, really, is operating in accordance with manufacturer specifications. So the driver is doing what they're supposed to do, and is handing over, and the vehicle is under the control of, under its own control, and then there is an incident of some kind, then in those circumstances, the Law Society say that the manufacturer is responsible. Now, I can absolutely tell you, having come from that background, the first thing the manufacturer is going to do is say, who's touched this vehicle since we built it? And anybody who touched that vehicle who wasn't seen to be properly qualified to do that work is going to find themselves in the dock, so to speak. You know, the manufacturer is going to say, well, that's what it was. You know, it wasn't our car that went wrong. It was the person who interfered with it who didn't know what they were doing. So it's pretty clear that that for everybody concerned, the manufacturers will want to know that people who are working on these cars are properly qualified. The owners want to know that. The employers, need to know that, because they don't want, you know, liabilities being thrown back at them. And the same goes for the person working on the car. So we're making sure the government keep, you know, that this doesn't get overlooked in whatever regulation comes forward. With connected vehicles, highly connected vehicles, there is existing regulation around data protection. But again, people need to be able to demonstrate that they are appropriately qualified around those data protection laws and everything else, and can basically knowingly sign up to their liabilities before accessing a car that may have, you know, someone's entire life data contained within it. So what we're talking about overall, James, is a shifted paradigm. We're going from an unregulated situation to one where there is basically not a single regulation. It's not blanket technician licensing, but it's saying if you want to do this thing and this thing and this thing, they individually need you, you're going to need to be qualified for. And these things aren't lifetime qualifications, because the technology moves. They are, you know, it's about gaining the appropriate level and then maintaining it. Like as we do with the EV stuff, where you have to either do CPD or be reaccredited. You know, either or both of those things are appropriate. But it's about maintaining that skill. So there are other elements of TechSafe, hydrogen as well. It is basically, though, for all the same reasons, there are safety issues associated with that, and the need to know that the people, you know, working around it are skilled and qualified to handle that technology properly. Sorry, that's a long explanation, but it is very necessary for people to understand that you know, what we're trying to do as the industry's professional body is to be that touchstone, as we should be. That's our job, is to say, look, you need this for your job. We have worked. We don't just come up with these things off the top of our head. We work with more than 70 organisations from right across the sector, you know, all of the subsectors and everything else, and say, look, you know, we don't want to just foist something on you. We want something that's workable for all of you. So let's work together to come up with it. But when we come up with it and everybody's happy with it, we then created something that the industry can sign up to and believe in. And actually that we should then boast about. That's what the professional register is all about, because, you know, when you've got qualifications, you need to talk about them. People need to know, you know, I've always said that, you know, what we stand for is the professional versus the unprofessional. And this is all part of that.
And is there a willingness to take on board the IMI TechSafe stuff?
Yeah, well, there certainly seems to be, James. I mean, if you look at the across the whole piece, there are something in excess of 700 qualifications that you can take that are automotive specific, and a great many of them are ours. But there are other awarding bodies, you know, that are well known out there that also have a collection of their own qualifications. Out of all of those qualifications, the most heavily engaged with qualifications are our EV qualifications. And I think it shows that people are I'll sort of with the programme. We've gone beyond the denial phase where people are saying it'll never happen. They are realising that EVs and PHEVs and all the other various electrified vehicles are a reality. They are coming. And actually, if you want to be part of that business going forward, this is what you need.
As big as the trajectory is for non-combustion engine vehicles, non-traditional powered vehicles, i.e. battery electric and plug-in vehicles, there will be a lot of businesses out there that either have seen a handful of battery electric vehicles come into the workshop or none at all, possibly. So how do you convince those people that IMI TechSafe recognition is worthwhile?
Well, it's peeling the onion, isn't it? I mean, I think when we first introduced IMI TechSafe, it's not surprising that the vast majority of individuals who were accredited and qualified came through manufacturers' academies, because the OEMs know that, you know, if you want to sell the things, you've got to have people appropriately qualified to work on them, and that's absolutely clear, isn't it? It took longer for the non-OEM people, the independent garages, to engage, but they are engaging, starting with the big guys, the big national chains, but more and more people are looking and saying there's an opportunity here. We can specialize, you know, we can and look, I don't kid myself that with a population of something like 33 million cars, approaching 40 million internal combustion engine vehicles in total, you know, once you include all the heavy vehicles and everything on the road, they aren't going to disappear overnight. They won't go away in 2030. They probably won't go away for another 15, 20 years. So there will be people out there who say, you know what, you know, I know that. I mean, I've heard people say it, you know, I can see out my time doing what I'm familiar with. I don't need to engage with the new stuff. And that's fine, isn't it? That's fine. But for anybody who's got a longer timescale that they're looking at, they absolutely have to be part of this. And the truth is that we see, we're seeing, we're not that far away from it. It's about 26, I think it is. 26, maybe 27, where electrified new vehicle sales will outnumber internal combustion engine new vehicle sales. I think it's about 25, isn't it? The prediction shows. So quite quickly, the population of electrified vehicles will grow, and then, you know, if we get to sort of 2030 and beyond. And we're somewhere back to probably not the 2.7 million cars that we sold before the pandemic, but certainly, you know, 2 million upwards a year. It doesn't take long, does it, for an awful lot of those, you know, to start to work their way through to, you know, beyond the franchise dealers. And so, you know, and I think we're seeing that recognition because more and more people and bigger numbers of people outside of the manufacturers dealers are engaging.
It's been spoken about for a long, long time, but the skill shortage and the need to bring new talent into the industry to make sure that it has the pool of talent available to succeed and continue to succeed and grow has been an issue for a long time. The work on diversity and inclusion is really important. It's something that the IMI has been working on for a while now, but what, I guess, an update on what the IMI is doing and why is it so important to the industry to open the net further to bring in talent?
Well, I mean, you've just said it there, James. I mean, I know that, I absolutely know that there will be a certain proportion of people out there who look at the whole equity, diversity and inclusion thing and think this is sort of just wokeism, if that's a word, you know. I'm a practical person. I mean, I've worked in this industry for a long time, and I believe in practical solutions to practical problems. We have a very practical problem, and that is an extreme shortage of people. we have no choice but to widen the net, to increase the appeal of working in our sector to people who've never ever considered it before. We know that historically automotive has been male dominated. To be blunt, it's been largely white male dominated, actually. There are times when, I've spoken to dealers and about this and sort of said to them, look, in simple terms, if when you look at the people in your showroom, your staff, if they don't look like the people, if they predominantly don't look like the people walking up and down the street outside, you might want to think about how you address that, because those people outside are your potential customers. And, we all kind of like a degree of familiarity or a degree of understanding of our differences, our cultural approaches and differences and so on. But it's just very, but that's there. Look, there's endless research that shows that a diverse team generally produces better results than a non-diverse team, because, it avoids collective blindness, doesn't it? There are some fantastic examples. I could cite loads of them really highly qualified, top teams, which have gone through the most incredibly tight selection, have missed something really obvious because they all come from the same background. But on a very simple, pragmatic level, it's just about saying, you can't solve the problem of lack of people by fishing in just part of the pond. We do need different skills going forward because the business is changing. The business is changing very more rapidly than it has ever changed in 100 plus years. And so we don't need identical skills to the ones we had before. That's not to say, I'm not suggesting for one minute that the people who are already in the business are no longer required, but we need to supplement that. The other thing is as well, when it comes to actually attracting particularly younger talent, never overlook the fact that what younger generations expect and buy into and their values that they support are very different to those of previous generations. I know that from my own children. They do more passionately believe in equity, diversity and inclusion than perhaps previous generations have. So when they're looking for somewhere to work, they look to see evidence of that. And they're not going to choose to work somewhere that, frankly, from their perspective, looks like it's stuck in the arc,
And I guess it's a continuous process as well, isn't it?
Of course it is, yeah.
The IMI Diversity Task Force released its report last year, but that's really just the beginning, isn't it? And you have to keep on with the conversations, etc.
Well, the truth of the matter is, the reason so much effort's gone into it is that you can make terrible mistakes if you assume you know what the issues are, the reasons, that the sort of issues that people might face, whether they are, whether it's about gender, race, disability, any of those things. It's, you have to talk to people who are actually affected, and you learn massive amounts of things from those people that most of us who are not directly affected are pretty ignorant of, actually. And even with the very best of intentions, you can get it horribly wrong. You can really get it horribly wrong. And so, we've sought to understand before we start, we were not in a position to give anybody advice because we didn't have any greater knowledge than anybody else did. So we've sought to work with people who can help us in that regard. And if they help us, we can then pass that advice on to others and help them be more effective at attracting, not just attracting, but retaining a more diverse workforce.
Okie doke. Well, unfortunately, as ever, we've run out of time. But for anybody listening who wants to find out more, either about the IMI response to the MOT consultation, IMI TechSafe, or indeed equity, diversity and inclusion, there's a lot more resources on the IMI website, which is theimi.org.uk. And other than that, unfortunately, it's time to bring this podcast to a close. But thanks for listening, and we'll see you again on the next one. Thank you very much.